language does funny things, because language is dependent upon, we make language. Language is not, words are not made of platinum, they're made of wood, I guess. And they depend on what meanings we assign to them, and if our life changes. In a day when, just for example, with the word bread, in a day where everybody grew their wheat and baked whole wheat bread, and bread was obviously the main staple of food and the main vitamin staple, not just crackers or little extras, but where it was really the substance, and where if you were poor, you still had bread and milk. It was central to the whole diet. Look what happens when we get to the point where what bread means probably, I mean, there are a few of us that buy whole grain, and there are even fewer who bake their own. So probably for 80 or 90% of America, bread means this white fluff stuff that tastes like sawdust. So bread doesn't, you can't count on bread saying bread. And our whole life is like that, you see. When our life changes, the meaning of the word changes, or the connotations of the word change. And so one of the major reasons that the Bible is always studied in community and not simply off by oneself is because what's in the book is the last translation. And you have to make the latest translation from your understanding of how your life has changed and how the language has changed. This is why in many ways biblical study is a kind of conversation between this talk over here and this talk over here. Did you come up with any ideas? How would you translate bread?
I think Luther is helpful, and when he suggests, in the catechism, what do we mean by daily bread? So he goes on to say everything that we need, such as home and family and food, of course, is sort of a total need of our life. It's both physical, spiritual, and somehow Christ kind of ties all those ends together, really. The one who sustains me, who gives me my ongoing life, or makes life possible, or the sustenance of life.
I think that's a good explanation. If you were a translator and could only have one word, or two words, I'll even give you three. Which of the words that you used do you think would convey most of? I think that one about daily bread, that's,
total nourishment or something.
That's not bad. That's not bad. What's this, this cereal? My kid is into total. Christ is the total. One would like something that was substantially, not just a thing, but that's good. Total. Nerf, either one of those, I think. If you were doing it really in terms of colloquial talk, you might just say Christ is the total. Christ is God's total. Or if you were doing it in language, maybe you would say heavenly nourishment. Nourishment's pretty good. Any other ideas? Sustenance is an excellent word.
How about nurture?
I think both nurture and nourishment somehow still feel green and growing and and not, you know, they're not rinky-dink. They're not trite. So I think both nurture and nourishment are really fine terms.
Rudy has an analogy of bread with the earth. Of course.
I was thinking this morning that maybe one of the analogies, bread was for their community, almost like land was for the Midwest. I don't know what land it means.
Holy earth produces what bread is made of.
And in many ways, you could talk about Jesus as God's land, God's earth. And it's interesting that even the earth is really the source of the Tillich metaphor, you know, when you talk about ground of existence or ground of being, to talk about God as analogous to that on which we stand. Keith, you're great. I'm going to, I think I'll ask you tomorrow about how you would translate the word life, or eternal life, and see what other ones. Oh, I think tomorrow I'll ask you about how you translate Father-Son. You see, problem with Father-Son, let me just toss this out. In the ancient world, Father-Son was an economic, almost a political. When you talk about Father-Son, you're not very far from talking from the king. And the king's son inherits, the eldest son inherits the property. So we're not just talking about something sexy, about two males that are passing on maleness to each other. We're talking about passing on someone who inherits the power of the other one, the authority, the ability to bring order and justice to the land. Well, in our kind of inheritance situation, daughters inherit just as much as sons do. And with nuclear families, men and women equally share a kind of ordering and nurturing roles. So it isn't a patriarchal society where authority and power and responsibility pass from father to son. It's a very different kind of family situation. And so when you just take that father-son bit, it gets warm and fuzzy and intimate, and you lose all the political, economic overtones that the king and his firstborn son, the relationship between the king and the firstborn son, the relationship between the patriarch and the next clan chieftain, all of that good, hard, ordering, justice-producing, responsibility stuff just evaporates because the father-son relationship in a nuclear family simply isn't like that. I mean, it's a very small remnant of those kinds of functions. So think about. I'm concerned about the father-son, not because it leaves the women out, but because it doesn't say what the original metaphor says. You see, the father-son language has become something in our lives that only says a teeny-weeny bit of what the original metaphor says. So it's really important to keep looking for those, translating the whole text. You see, this language is never parallel to this language. And so what is over here, this word only translates parts of what is over here. That's why very often, very, very often, you'll use two words. I will use two words. It sounds atrocious, but it's only, I don't know how, what else to do. For example, with the word spirit. The word spirit in Hebrew is exactly the same word as breath and wind. So, in fact, there are places in John 3 where you simply don't know whether the original intention was to say the spirit blows where it wills or the wind blows where it wills. And some of us think that, in fact, John used some words and meant both of them. So one way to talk about is the spirit wind breath blows where it wills. And that's really kind of interesting. Spirit has become so many funny things in our lives, in our churches. It's nice to get it back to, we still have wind. We still have wind and rain and storms, and so that the visual analogy or the physical analogy which connects with the concept of spirit, or against which the concept of spirit bounces, is the breath-wind one. And so, well, on to nitty-gritty. John 6. For those, I usually have a comment or two for those of you who are interested in sort of the theory of interpretation. And there are just two things I want you to note this morning. One is that if you put together the information about how the text of John has developed with what the text of John says, it looks like the fourth evangelist has a tradition over here, some of which he uses, and other of which he, and then goes on and elaborates in a different kind of diction, some of which he, and an awareness of tradition, but which he talks about in another language, whether he coined the language or whether this was a congregation which simply had a different vocabulary for talking about Jesus, it's a little hard to discriminate. But at any rate, there is a process of translation of the more primitive tradition into some kind of fresh language. And in a way, the text of John exhibits a paradigm for how to do Bible study in our own congregations. You have a text, and you have a new situation, and you translate from there to there. And so John itself reveals, the fourth gospel doesn't just reveal a still life, but reveals a cult, a process. What do you call it when you grow a culture? What?
Cultivate.
Yeah, incubate or cultivate. You see the cultivation of the wheat right in front of your eyes. Or you see the baking of the raising of the dough right in front of your eyes. So it's possible to not only learn something from the fourth gospel about what to say, but to learn something about how to go on doing what the fourth gospel did. There's a real irony in how we sometimes try to be faithful to our elders. We had on our, at the graduate faculty I attended, we had one of Karl Barth's sons as teachers, and we all thought that he was more Barthian than his father. You don't really want your children to do what you did. You want them to go on doing. You want them to carry on what you did and do what you would do, not what you did. In other words, you want the process to go on. So that some of the shrewdest imitators, some of the most faithful and loyal traditioners are the people who imitate the method of their parents rather than the results of, rather than conserve the results of their parents. I always thought that I had an uncle who founded a couple of the first all-English congregations in one of the old Norwegian groups, and I always thought that was a remarkably daring thing to do. You know, and it didn't mean that we should go on, you know, taking pride in having English congregations. It meant that we should really find a ministry that involved giving up as much as that kind of mission involved. But it's very hard to find, you know, we all want missions that don't involve giving up too much. And and some of the things that really need to be done take some. Well, the other exegetical principle I would put this way, to know our statement. The statement of a text is a combination of what the text says and what the text does. To know what you say is not simply the words, but also who you are, the kind of life you have. I'm done with this. Either it's words or life. There just aren't human beings that don't have bodies and actions, and there, and some words, and it's just not one or the other. You know, witnessing, for example, is not simply a matter of words or actions. It's obviously with everybody, whether you talk a lot or don't talk very much, it's obviously both what you do and what you say. And texts are just like that. Texts are just like that. They behave in certain ways, and so that it's very important to understand the dramatic behavior of a John text as well as what the words are saying. Or, put it another way, we wouldn't get anywhere unless we right away saw that the behavior of the word bread is metaphoric, but the behavior of the word God in John is not metaphoric at all. The behavior of the word Father, I think, is metaphor. The behavior of the word God is not metaphor. The behavior of the word believe is not metaphor. The behavior of the word see is metaphor. So the way we get the meaning is to look at both what the word says and what the word does. And you do this all the time. You do this all the time. If you pick up a newspaper, right away you think newspaper. You don't even think it. You just know newspaper. You walk into a church, you know something serious. You walk into, you see a commercial. It's the funniest thing. We just all click like this when that commercial comes on. I watch the CBS News, and then the commercial comes on, and I look at the newspaper, and I say, you know, this isn't serious. And so we all the time are looking at what we are deciding what something means by what kind of frame it's in. And so that's putting into words what we really do with these texts, but I want you to think about it. Okay, recapping the 25 through on section. Today we're doing 36 to 51. One of the lines that's important, I think, is because you ate your fill of loaves, not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of loaves. And I have sort of encapsulated this by talking about not only sign faith, but loaf faith or bread faith. Bread faith isn't enough. It may be a place to start. It may be a beginning. But bread faith isn't enough in the long haul. Somewhere along the line, in the nurture of Christian life, in the nurture of mature faith, one quits, one has to move from believing in Jesus and believing in God because they have done something for us to simply believing because they are. Because they are. And we mean something to them. Move from and it's just, I don't even know how to put it into words. I suppose I can draw a picture. I mean, we all have relationships which are built because of services rendered. And even sometimes within the family, our children appreciate us because of what we do for them. But there's a very subtle point where somehow or other relationships just are for no good reason. There isn't any reason anymore. They just are. In other words, the relationship is no more the means to the end, but the relationship is the end. And so that there is a kind of basic commitment and a basic trust, and you know that even when you're no good to them anymore, you're still as closely related to each other. Sometimes this happens in marriage, sometimes this happens in families, and I think that it can happen in the area of dependence upon God. And it seems to me that this there is a point at which bread faith, or even sign faith, isn't enough. And in the next couple of pericopes, we get into one way of talking about them, although, you know, there's some things wrong with this, but it still helps. What we get into talking about additional stages of faith, what I would call the Christ stage and the God stage and the cross stage. Okay, bread faith is not enough. One of the backgrounds, bread from heaven was introduced in yesterday, and this I didn't finish sort of spelling out the way I translate that. What really came down from heaven? When we talk about from heaven, when Jesus talks about coming down from heaven and that sort of thing, is this metaphorical or is this literal? I can't hear.
Well, in the Old Testament reference, it was in a very literal sense, wasn't it? The manna?
The manna was a descriptive term. How about here, when it's applied to Jesus, is it metaphorical or literal?
Depends where you're coming from. I mean, for some people,
Explain that. I don't know. What would it mean to...
As a Christian, it would mean... Alright. I was thinking of the ascension more than the coming down. Alright, it's metaphoric.
Right.
In that Jesus is still born,
exactly.
A baby...
Exactly.
In Bethlehem.
The common tradition was that Jesus was born. We have no reason to think that John rejected the common tradition. So there were people in the ancient world that thought of religious teachers. These Gnostics thought about religious teachers something like Mork, you know, somebody from another planet. And so there were little cults around where the language coming down from heaven was really taken as somebody from the next planet. But it's likely that the mainline Christians didn't think that way because they really thought that Jesus had a mother. So in terms of literal origins, they thought of Jesus as having parents. And in fact, in the text where it says, isn't this Mary's son and Joseph's son and so on, that's that was the common opinion about Jesus. So coming down from heaven, what does it mean when it's used metaphorically? What does it mean to say, well, I came down from heaven?
From God.
From God. I represent God. I have God's authority. I am from God. You've got to deal with me like you deal with God. In the Old Testament, there are two things that came down, so to speak, from above. And sometimes we have two major sources for metaphors. We have everyday life, and we also have our past. We have the old stories, which also give us metaphors. So, and bread, for example, get some of its flavor from the fact that it was on the table at dinner time, but it got some of its flavor from that manna story. That wonderful story about how when they were wandering around in the wilderness, there was a special accident and they were grumbling because, good heavens, we got out here in the wilderness. At least we had something to eat in Egypt. My goodness, you know, what's the use of being free and hungry? You know, you might as well then be slaves and have something to eat. And it was really that. Freedom is a very ambiguous thing. It takes very visionary people to keep people interested in freedom. Because after all, you know, when you come right down to it, the first task that you got to get done between morning and evening is to stay alive. Survival tasks, generally speaking, in human history, take precedence over meaning tasks. And it takes really very astute leadership to keep us engrossed in. But the trouble is, the survival level doesn't mean anything unless you work at the meaning level. So it's a very crazy situation. Okay, so that manna story. So that in one way, this is an exegesis of the manna story. The manna was, the way I think, sum up the manna story, it's an act of providence. It's a special sign. It wasn't just, it was the manna. I mean, every day they had this dewy stuff that they could eat. So it was nourishment. But it was more than that. When they remembered the manna story, they remembered it as the fact that somebody cared about them. Somebody cared about them. I mean, serving breakfast to your family is an act. I mean, it does help them. It does help them grow up and fill out and this sort of thing. But the truth is that they probably wouldn't get rickets if you didn't make breakfast. But there's more to serving breakfast than that. You know, there's a certain act of caring and affirmation in doing that is not only a physical act, but communicates a certain caring. So that manna is that kind of act. It was remembered as an action which not only sustained them as a community and as people, but also carried caring meaning or providential meaning. There's something else that came down from heaven in the Old Testament. Anyway, something big, and the Jews even called it bread from heaven sometimes. And I think it's in the Psalms or someplace, they called it the light.
The law. Torah.
See, when they were, God didn't just let them organize it. Their memory of their beginnings was that they not only got pulled together into a community and had a covenant contract where they affirmed God's offer of land and community, but God gave them direction, guidance. Leading. And this forever the picture of that is of Moses coming down from the mountain with these life directions, with the words which help them achieve a quality of life, a way of human life and existence that was worthy of God's people. The word law is again one of those words that, coming into the modern period, has suffered shrinking. In the ancient period, if you look at the book of Deuteronomy, law includes ideals, aspirations, religious institutions, some prohibitions, some moral axioms. It includes all of those things. Well, now, what does law mean now? It means civil and legal prohibitions, mostly. Most of us think of criminal law. There are a lot of, and most of us just, you know, when we think of a lot of the regulatory laws, we just think, I suppose most of it does something, some good, but it gets so complicated nobody can understand it. And, well, see, that isn't, so law isn't anymore a good way to translate what all that was. And so maybe a better way would be to talk about God's guidance, God's directions, God's human guidebook on how to be human or something like that. Okay, so in a way, I think we have to reckon with the fourth evangelist saying, all right, you know, Jesus is the new Torah. In other words, he's not saying something so different than the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus is, here we've got you, you got kicked out of the synagogue, but here's Jesus, and he summarizes, he interprets, he presents God's guidance, God's direction, God's meaning for your life. Now there's quite a difference. There's quite a difference in having a person be a direction rather than an elaborate set nevertheless that. Okay? John 6:36. I've broken this up into three sections, 36 to 40, 41 to 48, and 49 to 51. And 36 to 40 I call the mystery of unbelief. But I said to you that you have seen me, and yet you do not believe. This part of the dialogue is with what is a conversation, and still with the crowd, I think. All that the Father gives me will come to me, and him who comes to me I will not cast out. But I said to you that you have seen me, and yet you do not believe. Not everybody believes. Not everybody believes. How does this Jesus talk explain that? All that the Father gives me will come to me, and him who comes to me I will not cast out. If you believe, the Father has given you belief. Okay? And him, there's something not being said. There's something not being said. For I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. Important. Jesus could have come to establish himself as the center of a religious cult. Jesus could have come as a divine man figure to establish a new religious community. Jesus could have come as a political revolutionary to establish a revolutionary movement to overthrow the Roman government. For I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. Okay? People don't believe. People don't believe. So what do I do about that? The people that do believe are God's gift. The people that do believe are God's gift. And I'm sent to do God's work. I'm not sent here to just be successful. I'm not sent here to build my own religion. I'm not sent here with, for I've come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. And this is the will who sent, of him who sent me, that I should lose nothing of all those he has given me. Wow. This is a very intriguing statement. According to this way of understanding Jesus, Jesus does come simply to take care of and nurture those whom God has given him. He came to do God's will, not necessarily to be everything to everybody. This is very hard. This text in here I think it's very much earlier. It raises problems for us that are different than the problems of predestination. But for those of you who know the history of Christian theology, and you know all the arguments about predestination, is it man's freedom or is it God's will that people don't believe, you know? And know how long and hard and how vicious some of those battles are. And they're really important. They're really important questions. This is some of the text that inspired some of those controversies. So we're into real heavy text here. But it's very important that you see how different, how it implies a very different kind of thinking than those of us who believe, who are sort of raised on the notion that Jesus wanted everybody to be saved and Jesus was everything for everybody, and that God wants everybody to be saved through Jesus and things like that. It just doesn't say that. It simply does not say it. It says something different in this text. And that may be a good way to believe in the present, but it isn't what the fourth gospel is saying in this particular lesson. And this is the will of him who sent me, that I should lose nothing at all. What a modest, you know, just think of all the load it would take off your shoulders if you simply looked at your life as taking care of what God had given you to take care of. Instead of looked at your life as having to do for, take care of all the whole world for God. It's scary. I don't know if we can handle limited responsibility. You know, we can handle under responsibility and we can handle over responsibility. The quickest way to prove yourself a failure is to attempt more than you can possibly do. Then you can feel like a failure all your life. And there's a real dynamics, there's a real defensive dynamics to attempting to be the Messiah of the world. And so that to really accept responsibility for something that you can do, or almost do, and aren't really going to flop at, usually our religious thinking doesn't ask us to be that realistic. But I submit that there is in this whole understanding of Jesus a picture of Jesus, although John doesn't really dwell on Jesus' humanity particularly. That Jesus has always got practically a glow on him, and a glory glow. But there's something terribly, terribly realistic in it. And this is the will of him who sent me, that I should lose nothing of all that he has given me, but raise it up at the last day. For this is the will of my Father, that everyone who sees the Son and believes in him, you notice, that everyone who sees the Son and believes in him should have eternal life, and I will raise him up on the last day. So the Son is here. God gives to the Son those who see the Son takes care of, and these have life. And these have life. And in some very strange way, in some very strange way, when all is said and done, the people who recognize Jesus as Lord have done it not simply because of me or you, but have done it in some sense because of some drawing, some leading, some direction that comes from beyond us, or beneath us. You notice that the text doesn't say why people don't believe. It doesn't say that they don't believe because God tells them not to believe. It doesn't say that people who don't believe ought to believe. It just doesn't say it. In other words, it's quite clear about the process of coming to belief. But there's somehow unbelief is in the shadow. But it's a very interesting shadow, because somehow it isn't anymore my fault, and it isn't quite clearly the fault of the people who are not believing, and it isn't exactly the fault of God. It's somehow just in the shadow. And one of the strange things about this text is it can just lift off our shoulders that anxiety about unbelief. I think that one of the sort of diseases of our religion is this sort of unbelief, as though in order to believe and witness and be, we had to explain everything. Or in order to prove that we were worth something, everybody had to be here. We get that way in the family sometimes. In order to prove that we're worth something, all the children have got to be like us. And you know, that isn't true. I mean, you know, it's perfectly possible to live in a world where children go their own direction, and that doesn't mean we're not worth anything, or that there's something wrong with us. There is in life some openness. Some openness. So families, you know, there's some openness for individuals in the family to go different directions, and there seems to be in life some openness for people to believe and not believe. And it isn't fully explained where that openness comes from. You can't just say it's God's doing, and you can't just say it's the people's doing, and you can't just say it happens because I haven't done something. So, I'm asking, you know, when one of the interesting ways you understand paintings is by looking at what the painting is, the negative space. The negative space is part of the design of a painting. And what a text doesn't say is part of what the text says. And there have been many useless theological arguments, because they have not understood that when a text doesn't say something, it means not to say something. And there are some subjects that we would be more truthful if we didn't say anything. You know, when Jesus took off for the hills and kept his mouth shut. And this text explains something and hints at something, but it does sort of keep its mouth shut about the causes of unbelief. Not about the causes of belief, but about the causes of unbelief. And maybe we would be more gracious and better witnesses to the power of belief if we would kind of not fret so much, and have so much at stake. What we have at stake in believing. What we have at stake is in Jesus, not in what isn't believed. So, I don't know. There's something weird where we get so hung up on the negative space that we don't express the paradigm of the
I hear you saying then that that the thrust of this text is not really on belief or unbelief, but rather on God's initiative, God's presence, God's caring, God's bread in the world to be enjoyed, to be savored, to be experienced, to be celebrated, and that we turn it around and put the emphasis on our belief, our unbelief, or the reasons for that, rather than on God's gift of bread. Is that
I think that's a very fine way to say it. I think that the Jesus figure in the fourth gospel is preoccupied, has a almost Schleiermacherian God consciousness, and he's absorbed in and represents the presence of being in his mission, in all of life, and that he is inviting his disciples to share this preoccupation and to recognize that this being works through him.
Isn't that the Jesus story for God sent his son out into the world to condemn the world, that the world might have life through him, or however that goes on? That rejoicing in the bread being in the world. I wanted to ask you, what are some of the, in contemporary translation, what's some of the, your initial point when we start out, bread, faith, things that are happening in our contemporary world? Maybe I'm not saying that way. Are you with me at all at the very beginning? Or?
I'm partway with you. I'm not sure what your last...
Well, maybe I should think it over. And are we going to have discussion time a little bit later on? I might be able to rephrase.
All right. Just one. I think you caught the theme. You've done a good job of elaborating the theme and the point that I was making. One thing to be said about the whole fourth gospel is that it's quite clear that the fourth gospel understands this preoccupation with the positive power of God through faith to be a very critical, conflict-raising sort. You will cause more trouble, probably, by refusing to have glib answers about unbelief than if you knew all the answers. When you keep your mouth shut at certain points, and you don't hang on to easy answers, your people are going to get mad at you, because you're just going to spoil all kinds of security systems. You're just going to spoil all kinds of security systems. Because one of my points about this whole thing is that Jesus seems remarkably unanxious. And I just think that we live in an age, just the older I get, the more I think that more of what we do, I always thought when I was younger that most of what we did was because we were intending to do something. And the more older I get, the more I think that half of what we do is because of something we're getting away from. You know, you end up doing first what bugs you the most, not what you want to do. You know, you end up acting in terms of what you're mostly afraid of, what you're most afraid of, rather in terms of what you most want to achieve. And there's really a difference. There just is a lot in this text that has to do with anxiety and I think there's some real analogies. I think I'm trying to work on Vespers out of this chapter, and I couldn't help thinking there were some real analogies with consider the lilies of the field, don't, and the birds of the air. Take a good look, when you're up here, take a good look at the mountains and just think about how long the glaciers have been around and some of this, and how long, how many years the trees have survived and things like that. You know, then the next section, 36 to 41 to 46, the Jews murmured at him because he said, "I am the bread which came down from heaven." If they understood him as claiming to be Torah, they should murmur. That's really a rather revolutionary thing, to claim to personify and to represent God's guidance and direction. Well, isn't this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? There is here a kind of historical reductionism. Notice, Jesus said, "Do not murmur among yourselves. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent him draws him." They are assuming that responsibility is dynastic, that it follows channels. And some of the most creative, revolutionary, prophetic things happen seemingly arbitrarily. Seemingly arbitrarily. The wind blows where it wills, and the Spirit of God happens and inspires whom he or she wills. And there is something disgustingly surprising and arbitrary about new spiritual insights and spiritual breakthroughs. And they are not perceiving this at all. They're thinking that everything depends upon the transmission of authority, and after all, Jesus is just, well, everybody has a father and mother. That touch of contribution which goes on beyond what you have been given in a historical way is a very mysterious thing. Don't murmur among yourselves. No one can come to me unless the Father who has sent me draws him, and I will raise him up at the last day. And it is written in the prophets, and they shall be taught by God. Again, Jesus, there is an implication here that you can see why the Calvinists got the idea that if people didn't believe them, God must not have sent them. That is the logical corollary of this, but it isn't stated. It is written, "Everyone who heard and learned from the Father comes to me, not that anyone who has seen the Father except him who is from God, and he has seen the Father." Would you notice that there is here what I would call Jesus exhibits a kind of God faith. In other words, Jesus doesn't exhibit a Jesus faith. Jesus exhibits a God faith. Now that's a perplexing thing. We believe in Jesus, but if we take seriously Jesus, then we have to take seriously what Jesus demonstrates. And Jesus demonstrates a God faith. Now that's a complicated dimension. Now that's why we end up with something as interesting and fascinating and as valuable as the doctrine of the Trinity. But don't simplify that tension, because even Jesus' faith is not enough. Even Jesus' faith may not. It just doesn't come out right if you've got Jesus only and no God, or if you've got Jesus, God sort of collapsed into Jesus, rather than Jesus representing and being loyal to God. I don't know how to explain it, but you get the depth. There is a depth in Jesus' God faith that there isn't in Jesus' faith. And so notice how in all of this, one of the things, you know, you'd think that Jesus would have had a nervous breakdown because he wasn't very successful. And he didn't. He really didn't. He just was tough and he sweat out Gethsemane, and he died without really getting bitter. You know, he just didn't. Why? Basically, because he wasn't, he didn't, his task just wasn't to be God, it was just to do God's work. The distinctions I'm making are just sort of paper-thin distinctions, but there really is a distinction between feeling like you've got to act for God and feeling like you've got a job that God's given you to do, that you can do, and you do it and you don't sweat it. You know, there's something, and I don't know why we do it, but I do it all. You know, I get trapped into things so many times where all of a sudden I'm not only carrying the burden of the job, but I'm carrying the burden of the whole world in this one little job. And it's stupid. And in a way, this text suggests that the notion of Jesus was Jesus in Gethsemane wasn't really personally. It turned out that what Jesus did was the sign of the salvation of the world, but doesn't mean that Jesus carried the world on his shoulders. All he carried on his shoulders was that he had to do God's will. And that's really a more modest, manageable frame of reference than if you somehow do all the worrying for the whole wide world. Because there's something about the relationship between human beings and God where you really end up letting God do the worrying. In the God-human relationship, God can do the worrying and we can do some of the work. Third 47, truly, truly, I say to you, he who believes has eternal life. I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and they died. This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that a man may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread which I give for the life of the world is my flesh. Okay, the 60th, the big word, the really big word is, it seems to me, flesh. The bread that I give for the life of the world is my flesh. You've got more of the sort of Jesus, the God faith. You've got a rehearsal of all the themes of the chapter, bread of life, manna in the wilderness. This bread, incidentally, when it says that a man may eat of it and not die, is that metaphorical or literal? Is that literal or metaphorical? Okay, they knew Jesus had died, and they knew whatever belief in resurrection, it was a notion of being raised after death, so that the language not die is not straight descriptive; it's in some sense metaphorical. What does that sentence mean? The bread which I give for the life of the world is my flesh. That's a hard one. There are some legitimate differences in how to interpret it. I think I like that line of reasoning myself. What can you say?
Is John thinking of the Eucharist too?
Aha. This is, that's a very important question, and that's we probably should get into that. Have some discussion of that. Is this pre-Eucharist or is this Eucharist? Is John maybe conscious of Eucharist? Or maybe there's a congregation without a Eucharist where there's just simply rich metaphorical language. It's hard for us to imagine a church without Eucharist. And so it's very easy for us to get John, have John talk about baptism, and the commentaries are just fabulous. I can find baptism in the Eucharist all the way through this book, if I want to.
I think we're jumping the gun if we say it refers to that.
My own personal opinion is that there is no clear, unambiguous reference to congregational practices of baptism or celebration of meals. And that it looks like, and here I am, it may just look like, I interpret flesh as a reference to the cross, to the death on the cross, and I don't think there's anything wrong in having the language nurture Eucharist. Because in a way, Eucharist is its own kind of metaphor. Certainly, Eucharist is connected with the old Passover, and where you, in the synoptic traditions, you have this quite clear, that it's instituted at Passover time. My hunch is that John, my conviction or my conclusion is that John really wants to say that Jesus is Passover. And John will have no problem with people going on to say that Jesus is present in Eucharist. But he's really not put it another way, I understand John to be affirming primary symbols rather than secondary symbols. Understand.
What does that mean?
I understand him to be talking at the level of how does Jesus mediate God, not does how the Eucharist and Scripture and teaching mediate Jesus. You see, at the bedrock, Jesus is part of the fundamental expression of God. Jesus became part of the Holy Trinity, but Eucharist and Bible and preaching never became part of the Holy Trinity. So that what we talk about in technical language as primary level and secondary level. So that Jesus is the Bible is the Word of God because it has something to do with Jesus. Jesus is the Word of God. Jesus is its being what it is depends on this being what it is. It isn't that there is any less meaning in the secondary. It's just that the secondary depends upon the primary, and not the primary on the secondary. Well, I don't want to say that. They are interdependent, but the one is more fundamental than... What?
Groundings.
Yes, the one is the roots of this in a way that this isn't the roots of this.
Vern, is the same, the flesh word, the same as the prologue, 1:14? I can't, what's your Nestle say? Is it the same thing?
And the word became flesh. I'm sure it's the same word, whether it is the same use of the word, I'll have to think about that. I'll think about that over
there. Okay.
I had a thought. I was looking at that flesh, and I went back to the meaning that a lot of my non-Lutheran Christian friends use.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, in that, as I am now, he's taking on, when he says, I am the flesh, he's taking on an attribute of God that isn't, so it's getting not, so he's not so much God's representative anymore, but he is God himself. Well, I would be, am I wrong? Is he still representing?
Mm-hmm. I guess I'd have to hear more of what you mean by what you're saying, and I'd like to. I guess I see what I think is important in the word flesh is that it introduces the whole business of the cross. It introduces the whole business of death and cross. And I don't know enough about what you mean to know that you're wrong, but I don't want to lose the meaning of the flesh as heading for the cross, because the theme of the cross is very important for the fourth gospel. Because, for example, in the first chapter, you get the notion of becoming flesh in John 1:14, but by the end of the chapter, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. John 3, the Son of Man must be lifted up, a reference to the cross. 6, 7 chapters of the Gospel of John are on the cross. When all is said and done, the incarnation flows into atonement. And it isn't just that God became human, but that the kind of humanity that God took on was a very carefree, hang loose, God agenda type of humanity. God agenda type of humanity. And so where I'm at on that word is that it was such a breakthrough for me to see the cross in that word, where I had seen mostly Eucharist for years. But I'm still stuck there. But I'd like to hear more of your, I'd like to hear more of your argument, because unfortunately for me, and sometimes for my students, I change my mind. the life goes on and somebody else has a better idea. You have to change your mind.